Thank you. Yes, Yekosha. Thank you, everybody. Hello, and I want to wish everyone a good Chodesh Nisan. As you heard, Nisan is the month of Geula. Chazal say, "Ben Nisan Nigalu, we were redeemed in Nisan. Uben Nisan Asidin Lihigael, and the future redemption is most likely to take place in Nisan. Although, of course, Mashiach can come every single day except Shabbos. So Mashiach can come today still, or Yom Tov as well. But nevertheless, in terms of probabilities, Nisan is the month of Geula. So B'ezras Hashem, we all are looking forward to a month of Geula. I had mentioned last week, and this will be my entree, that if we had to choose perhaps the most important sentence in the Haggadah, it would be Chayav Adam Liros Asatzmo Kiilu Hu Yatzam in Mitzrayim. Every person must regard themselves as if they themselves were taken out of Mitzrayim. And I mentioned the explanation of the Baal HaTanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadeh, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, that what does that mean? That does not mean I was a slave in Egypt, I was not a slave in Egypt, but rather Mitzrayim has a double meaning. It is Egypt, the ancient Egyptians, but it also refers to limitations and constrictions and boundaries that constrain me and block me and suffocate me in my ability to connect to Hashem and to the essence of my own neshama. David HaMelech says, "Min ha-meitzer karasika," I call out to Hashem from the narrow, confining spaces. And therefore, the Baal HaTanya tells us that the obligation to regard yourself as if you yourself had left Mitzrayim requires that you identify the Mitzrayim within yourself, whether it's arrogance or gaiva or anger or conceit or lack of self-esteem for that matter, whatever it is. And by identifying the Mitzrayim within you, you have the power to tap into the spiritual kochos of redemption that HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes available during Leil Seder and during Pesach. And therefore, the Haggadah as a whole is a double conversation. And again, I emphasize it's double because one is not to the exclusion of the other. On one hand, it is the national story of Am Yisrael. It is how we were created as a nation. It is our legacy. It is our history. It is how we became the Am Hashem. And we communicate that from parent to child intergenerationally, so that every Jewish child should know what it means to be a Jew. That, of course, is the basic message of the Haggadah. But, in addition, there is a private, idiosyncratic conversation going on in which every person identifies the personal slavery that they have and that they turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to redeem them from their own personal slavery as well. Okay, so there is a double meaning in the Haggadah. There is what you might call the public community meaning, and then there is the private idiosyncratic meaning. And both of those conversations are going on simultaneously. And therefore the idea that, in fact, there are even Haggadahs that are written about the aspect of inner slavery, and sometimes these may even emanate from non-religious sources. They connect Pesach to all sorts of inner psychological struggles. And although perhaps the overall orientation of these works may leave a lot to be desired, they may not necessarily be religious, but they are hitting on an insight that in point of fact is a true insight. That is, Pesach is also about the individual slavery that we go through. So what I want to do something, I want to connect these ideas to the parsha that we read yesterday and we're going to read this coming week. You know, Chumash Vayikra is bichlal, a very, very difficult chumash, although it used to be in the time of Chazal, and in some places even today, it was the first chumash that we taught young children, because they're pure, right, just pure little kids, and korbanos are pure, so those who are pure should learn that which is pure. Later in most places, at least certainly America, it's out of vogue because Vayikra is very, very difficult. Korbanos, technicalities, hard for us to understand. But if you have to pick something that's the hardest of the hard, it is really the Parshios of Tzoras. Tzoras is literally, you know, putting aside what the spiritual meaning of all of it is a labyrinth of detail. It's extremely difficult to even follow along in the Chumash. If you read the Parsha yesterday and you were not confused, either you didn't understand or you're a super genius. So those are the two possibilities. Because, l'fi pshuto shel mikra, it's very, very hard to figure out what on earth is going on. But normally, the Parshios of Tazria and Metzora, which are usually on a non-leap year, are read together anyway, are read after Pesach. But in a leap year, because we have four extra weeks, we actually get it in before Pesach. And I assume there are no accidents, of course, and if HaKadosh Baruch Hu enabled us to read about leprosy before Pesach, there will be a Pesach message even within that. First, as all of us know, the Rambam, who was of course a very, very eminent physician, does make the point that saras is not in the nature of a communicable disease. He points out that some people say, you know, saras is an illness, and the need for quarantine is an early recognition that people that have contagious diseases should not be with people. Right? That's how a doctor might view it. But the Rambam, as a great doctor himself, says that is not the case. And he proves it from two points. Now, one point is a weaker proof, one point is a stronger proof. The weaker proof that the Rambam says is that when a person has saras, he goes to a kohen to determine what his treatment is. So the Rambam says, why a kohen and not a doctor? So it seems we're dealing with spiritual problems. We're not dealing with physical problems. Now, I call that a weak proof, because the truth of the matter is, in the ancient world, Kohanim were often doctors, so consequently, there wasn't much of a difference. But there's a second proof that's very interesting. And that is, the Gemara says, or the Mishnah says, since when a person is declared a Metzora, he has to be quarantined, the Kohen is not allowed to paskin at times when that would interfere with his simcha and his time of joy. So for example, if you have a chasen or a kala during Sheva Brachos, and they develop the white splotch on the skin that is characteristic of tsaras, the Kohen is not allowed to declare him a Metzora during Sheva Brachos, or during Yom Tov or Chol HaMoed, because the quarantine would take away the simcha and the joy of the occasion. Now the argument is, if you're dealing with a dangerous situation, that doesn't make sense. That's like saying, let's not do emergency surgery, you know, during Sheva Brachos because we can't mar the simcha. Yeah, but people might die or whatever it is. So the Rambam says, it's very, very clear from here, that although saras is a physical manifestation, it is not in the nature of disease. It's not contagious in a physical sense. Now, of course, the translation of tsaras is leprosy. There is a disease that used to be called leprosy. In fact, that term itself is not used that much. It's Hansen's disease. And that does not at all correspond with the Torah's description of tsaras anyway. So leprosy is not an accurate translation. In fact, the closest thing to tsaras, which sounds like tsaras, is psoriasis. And in fact, psoriasis actually comes from tsaras. It was a Greek term that entered the Greek language through the Septuagint, which says psoras is psoriasis, etc. And indeed, it does correspond that way. But Chazal tell us, I mean, don't worry, by the way, if anyone has psoriasis, it is not halachically tsaras. I'll get to that. But I don't want to scare anybody until I get to that point. But the Gemara itself says that there are different types of saras, right? There's saras on the person, which comes primarily because of the sin of lashon hara. There is saras on garments, that comes primarily because of the sin of gasus haruach, gaiva. And there is saras of houses, which comes from the sin of selfishness with sharing your possessions, that is called sorus oyen. So the primary ideas are saras haguf lashon hara, saras begadim gasus ruach, saras batim is sarus ayin, selfishness in sharing your possessions. That is why the Torah says when your house gets saras, you have to take out all of your possessions into the street so everybody sees all the things you didn't want to share with other people. Again, it just reminds me, my mother, Shalom, used to talk about when the years in Siberia, and she mentioned that there were people who came to Siberia and they took jewelry with them. They took jewels with them as a way of trying to keep alive, diamonds or whatever it is. But even if they were starving and they needed food, they would not part with their diamonds. And she knew personally a woman who died because she refused to give up the diamond. That's an idea of Tzoras Ayin, even for your own survival, not being able to part with it. Okay, but be it as it may, tzoras of the body is further subdivided in ways that I will just mention. I'm not going to go into. There is what you might call, no pun intended, plain vanilla tzoras, which is simply white splotches on the skin. Then there's a special halacha of tzoras in the hair areas of the hair. And then there's tzoras that results after a burn or a blister. And all of them have different types of halachas. But what I want to go through here is what I call plain vanilla tzoras. I want to take you through it in a little bit of detail. And this may be more about tzoras than you would care to know per se, but I think it'll be very, very helpful to see the application of these lessons to our own spiritual development. First, Ramban makes a very important point. Ramban makes a point that tzoras, in a sense, is actually a gift from Hashem. It is divine feedback as to specifically what I have to correct in my life. That's an amazing thing. You know, when I taught law school, and you know, typically in a law school class, we only give one final at the end of the semester. And, you know, that can encourage somebody not to, in fact, I even did it as a student, not to do anything until the last week in which you try to learn the whole course or whatever it is. But one of the recurring complaints of students is, we want feedback, we want to know how we're doing. And in Ruchnius, it's the same thing, you know. I wish Hashem would tell me what I need to correct. Well, tzoras is not a pleasant reminder, but it is a direct divine statement. And because of this, the Ramban makes the very startling assertion that tzoras exists only in times when there is prophecy. When Hashem directly communicates to human beings, tzoras is one of the vehicles of communication. So a mitzvah is a shtickel nubi, at least with respect to himself. When there's no nevuah, then you don't have that direct communication, which is why someone that has psoriasis, etc., doesn't have to worry. We don't have nevuah, therefore it doesn't have that particularized meaning that tzoras would otherwise have. So that's one thing. Tzoras is a form of divine prophecy and feedback. That is why it applies only in Eretz Yisrael. There is literally no halacha of tzoras. Now again, you may ask the question, we read about Naaman. So again, the way the Mefarshim explain, Naaman did not have halachic, first of all, he's a guy. So Naaman did not have halachic tzoras. He had a skin condition. So it uses tzoras as a borrowed term for something that physically resembles tzoras. But it did not have that spiritual implication. Because the spiritual implication of tzoras is only in Eretz Yisrael and only Bizman HaNevuah. Another aspect of tzoras is the centrality of the Kohen. You may remember the old baseball umpire's refrain, or maybe your husbands will remember it. That is, I forgot the exact language, but he says, you're not out until I call it out, or something. I don't remember the exact nature. Meaning to say, the umpire creates the reality. And in tzoras, it's very much that case. A person is not halachically a mitzora until the Kohen says he is. It's not that when the Kohen says he is, that shows he was a mitzora. He does not become a mitzora till the Kohen says he is. The Kohen creates the reality. Why is the Kohen so important here? So there are two ideas reflected in the notion of the Kohen creating the reality. Number one, the Mitzvah is a person who has used his power of speech to destroy, to divide, to make machlokas, to make dissension. We want him to go to the Kohen because the Kohen exemplifies symbolically the midah of Ohev Shalom Verodev Shalom, to remind a person, use your words for good. Use your words to strengthen, to build up, to comfort, to be mechazek, to encourage. Learn from the Kohen. Remember, the idea of Shemiras HaLashon is not to be quiet all the time. Hashem wants us to talk. Hashem wants us to communicate. Hashem wants it. A person simply bites his lip day after day. He's not using the faculty, which is called the divine faculty of man. The Nefesh Chaya, the Targum Onkelos says, is the Ruach Mamalel. In fact, it's much easier to simply not talk than it is to use your words in a good and a positive way. Learn from the Kohen. That's one thing. There's a second lesson in this, however, and that is the Baal Lashon Hara sometimes has a certain excuse to himself. He says, it's just words, you know, sticks and stones, break bones, names won't hurt me or hurt the other person. Right? Words don't have realities. So we put him in a situation where it's exactly the words that do create the realities. You think words don't make differences? Go to this Kohen. If he says you're Tameh, you become Tameh. If he doesn't say you're Tameh, you're okay. What's the difference? You can have the identical physical condition. The words make the difference. You think words don't matter? Look at the Koach HaDibur. And in fact, I mentioned before, you know, if you listen to these interviews with the various political figures who may not have turned out totally well at the end, whether it's Hitler, not interviews, but at least history, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, Stalin, Yimach Shemo, and, you know, I don't mean to compare him, but this is Richard Nixon, who had his own problems. Again, I don't mean at all to compare him to that list. Saddam Hussein, which I would, you know, put back in that list. You often find an amazing thing, you know, it's almost like startling, that events in their childhood. Richard Nixon was talking about how, you know, he remembers the taunt. This is after he resigned the presidency. He remembers the taunts in the playground in fourth grade that he never got over. Well, you know, how many decisions do these adults who make decisions that impact on millions of people are doing so? Some kid in the fourth grade refused to play with him. That kid didn't realize, you know, Achimeir Yesrim Shana, you know, be responsible for Watergate. Oh, Din B'cheshbon. In fact, this is true for all of us. We don't realize how the little insignificant things we do could have changed the world in some way. But it's very, very true. It's very, very true. People who play with nuclear bombs, to some degree, are just acting out playground issues that never got resolved. It's very, very, it's kind of an amazing thing. Little kids have little toys, and big kids have bombs and other things. And these things happen. Again, this does not mean to exonerate people of responsibility, but it does mean that all of these are causative factors. So the Mitzvah goes to the Kohen in order to understand the Koach of Dibur. So now, let's go through a Mitzvah case step by step, and then you'll see what this can mean for us. Person wakes up one morning, day after Sheva Brachos, not during Sheva Brachos, and finds a white, either man or woman, finds a white splotch of discolored skin. So he is obligated to go, huh?
By Harris?
Yeah, a Mitzvah, yeah.
By Harris?
Well, Harris is one of the shades. By Harris or Seis. So there's a mitzvah d'oraisa, so that they are mechuyev to go to a Kohen. The Kohen looks at this nega, and the Kohen really has to determine two things. He has to determine the size of the nega, because if it's not big enough, it's not a problem. And he also has to determine the requisite shade of white. Now, you have to have very good eyes for this, and many of us would not be sensitive today. But there are many, many different shades of white. This is Baheres, is a very bright white, like new snow. And then a lesser shade is Seis, and that's like the wool on a lamb. But if it's a dark white, an off-white, or a pastel, it would not be Tzaras. So essentially the Kohen determines two things. The Kohen determines size, and the Kohen determines requisite whiteness. Now, if the size is not big enough or the whiteness is not big enough, guy goes home and simply goes to a dermatologist, and there's no more halachic issue that is involved. But let's say the Kohen makes a determination that this halachically meets the standard of Tzaras. What then happens is there is what we will call a provisional quarantine. And the term for that is Hesker. Hey, Samach Gimel Reish. The Mitzorah is called a Mitzorah Muskar. Provisional. You'll see why it's provisional. He is quarantined. He is put in a private place, away from everybody. Seven days later, the Kohen makes a second examination of the person. Now, on day seven, that second examination, the Kohen is looking for one of three additional things that have been added to the neg. Now, if the neg is just there by itself, that's not yet. And these things are called simanei tuma, signs of impurity. And all you need is one of them. And you'll see in a moment what happens if he has one of them. The first sign of tuma is that if in the nega there was a black hair, let's say, for example, that the nega was on an arm, a place that has a hair growing. So if the black hair turned white within the nega, that is a siman tuma. Or, the nega is bigger. So when the Kohen first examined him, the Kohen took a measurement of the nega. If the nega expanded, that's a second siman tuma. That's called pisayon, pasaha nega, impasaha nega. If the nega expanded, the Mishnayic term is pisayon. Interesting, the Chumash spells pasa with a sin. The Mishnah spells pisayon with a samach. What's the word for peacock? Isn't the same word? What's the word for peacock in Hebrew? No, for a peacock, I'm talking about. Don't they have pisay or pheasant? Or pheasant, what do they say?
Passion.
Oh, pasiyah, as I say, yeah, pheasant, that's what I meant, yeah. So it's similar to a pisayon. And the third simon of tumah, now this is counterintuitive, is if in the middle of the white nega there developed a little healthy patch of flesh, which we might think is a sign of getting better, but for reasons to be explained, that is called michya, live good flesh in the middle. That's a siman tuma. Now, if on day seven he has any one of those simane tuma, he graduates, he's upgraded or downgraded, as you call it, from a provisional mitzora to a definitive mitzora. And the term is, he's no longer a muskar, he is now a mukhlat. And once he's a mukhlat, he does not get out of the status until the nega totally goes away. He counts 7 days and he brings sacrifices. Okay, because he graduates from muskar to mukhlat. Now, what if on day seven he still has the nega, but he doesn't have any of the simanei tuma? He doesn't have any of the three signs. So there, he is kept in provisional quarantine for a second week. And on day 14, the Kohen once again examines him for one of those simanei tuma. If he has any of those simanei tuma, he graduates to mukhlas. But this is interesting. If by day 14, the muskar does not have a siman of tuma, even if he has the very same nega which resulted in his quarantine, he goes home. If he does not have simanei tuma by day 14, even if he has the nega, he goes home. Right? In other words, there's two checks, day 7, day 14. Yeah, there's all sorts of discussions. What if he gets the simanim in the middle of the 7-day period? What if he gets the simanim after he goes home? Okay, those are questions we don't have to deal with, but this is the normal procedure. So let's try to make sense of this and see what lesson this might be conveying. Right? I know it's a bit detailed, but it's worthwhile to, what is the Russian expression? God is in the details. And indeed in Torah, that very much is the case. So here is the story. First, the unique sanction or the unique status of the Mitzora is he is the only one of the Tumot that is quarantined, that is put in isolation. Why is he put in isolation? So again, there are two ideas here. One is we understand that Lashon Hara destroys communities, it destroys families, it breaks down connections between people by replacing it with bitterness. So we remove the Metzora from society as if to say he's a public menace. Now, we don't look at people who speak Lashon Hara as a public danger. But the Torah is merames that Lashon Hara is so destructive. We remove him from society so he will not endanger and inflict more and more damage. But there's another reason as well. You may remember, grammar school, used to call it junior high school, now they call it middle school in the United States, whatever the Israeli equivalent is. So there was a short story that they used to assign us, The Man Without a Country. And this was a story about a fellow that participated in an early rebellion against the newly founded United States. You know, Aaron Burr was trying to overthrow the government, and this guy was as well. So at his trial, he basically said he cursed the United States and he hopes to never hear about it again or see it again. So the judge issued a decision that his punishment would be he would be on a boat and nobody would ever be allowed to mention anything about the United States again. And the story basically showed that he needed his country, he needed his community, and being separated from it made him realize how important it was. So here we tell the Baal Lashon Hara the following message. You think creating disunity, machlokas, division, no big deal. We want you to know what it's like to be lonely. We want you to know what it's like to be separated. We want you to know what it's like to be in isolation. Feel the pain that you caused others. And by feeling the pain that you caused others, you will then be able to do tshuva. In fact, it's brought down in some Svarim, although I don't know what the source for this is. It's brought down in later Svarim. That what is Gehenna? There are many different images of Gehenna that are portrayed. But one understanding of Gehenna is, at least in Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, is Hashem allows us or makes us feel the pain that we caused others without any of the excuses and justifications that we gave ourselves. And that's the meaning of the phrase, we make our own Gehenna. That's exactly right. Gehenna is not something Hashem puts on us. It is simply the Gehenna that we made. And we feel. And indeed, that is a primary way of doing tshuva. Primary way of doing tshuva, at least in the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, is try to imagine what the other person feels like. If you can. And then you want to do tshuva. So the whole purpose of the quarantine is to let the Metzora recognize what it's like to be lonely, friendless, without support. And then he understands what Lashon Hara does. I mean, you can rest assured, now we don't know the measure, that certainly a person who spoke Lashon Hara once or accidentally, he's not the one that gets Saras. Saras has to be somebody that's pretty bad, we would have to assume, although I can't quantify what the measure would be. And this is the idea of the quarantine. So here is the idea of the Siman Tuma. If the original Saras is a message from Hashem, do tshuva, and the quarantine is the mechanism by which he reflects and comes to tshuva, the existence of the Siman Tuma is a secondary message from the Almighty. Hey, you're not ready to go home yet because you have not really done the tshuva process. Go back and think about it some more. So the concept is, the tsaras is the primary message. You have a sin for which you need tshuva. The siman tuma, as you'll see in a moment, is the secondary message. You're not ready to go home and complete your tshuva because there's something wrong here. Yeah?
From a physical point of view, when you mentioned the three different simanim,
yeah,
what was going through my head was, each of them shows that there's still activity going on. You call expansion, but there's still
right.
Biological activity.
Yeah.
Something going on, whether a hair is sprouting, turning a color.
Whether
there's expansion of the, right, the measurement.
Right.
Or whether there's you said
the healthy flesh in the middle.
Flesh.
Right. Right.
That means that something is still going on.
That's right. Well, on the most basic level, that's true. I'm going to elaborate on that a little bit, but that's basically the idea. I just want to identify the messages a little more. So this thought. What do the Simani Tuma represent as a secondary message? Is developed in a Sefer Drash Vayayin, the Reish Rav, one of the great Rabbanim in Poland, before World War II. I'm elaborating on it somewhat, but it's taken from foundationally from his remarks, and he says the following: when a person is confronted with averus that they've done, we immediately move to the modality of defense and excuse to ourselves. In other words, we're not comfortable with the idea that I have to change. We're not comfortable with it that I might be wrong. In fact, there's a famous story about Nevardik. Now, Nevardik Musser, and this deserves a whole talk on its own, Nevardik Musser was very, very concerned with always being truthful to yourself. So they tell the story about two yeshiva boys who were learning Gemara, and each of them had a totally different explanation, and they were screaming at each other. And finally, one said to the other, "You're right." So the other said, "That's not good enough. You have to say you're wrong. You can't just say I'm right. You have to be willing to say you're wrong, because until you say you're wrong..." Now, what's interesting is, think about this, even in... I assume nobody here ever gets into disagreements, but even in a... but it is actually physically easier to acknowledge somebody else is right than to say the words, "I am wrong." It is actually hard. It is hard to say those words, because there's something in us, maybe I'll speak for myself, that maybe rebels in part on the notion. So, the very first thing a Metzora might do when he's confronted, of course, who is he arguing with? God? Who is he fooling? Himself? But he might say, "Well, okay, I got this mark on me that says I'm a Baal Lashon Hara. But how bad could it be? Number one, he deserved it." These are not halachic justifications. "Number two, he does worse. I only said part of how bad he is. Number three, it really didn't hurt him that much." We go through all sorts of justifications. In English, when you try to cover up a bad situation, that is called whitewashing. So the black hair turning white says, "Aha, Hashem knows your thoughts. You are still giving yourself defenses. You're still giving yourself excuses. Go back for another week and think about it." Now, if there's no white hair at the end of the week, he goes home. Even though he has the tzaras, he can finish the tshuva at home. But as long as he's whitewashing, giving himself excuses, no good. We have to recognize what we've done. Okay, second excuse. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. The second excuse moves in the opposite direction. Unlike the whitewasher, who denies what he's done, he gives himself excuses and defenses. The second problem we have is, we might be very aware, maybe only too aware, of what we've done. But we feel we've done such a bad thing that we are now hopeless. We think we've been on the wrong road for so long. There is no way of turning back. No way of getting back. What's the point of even trying? Because I'm so far gone. I'm overwhelmed with guilt, and I'm overwhelmed with the enormity of what I've done. That is the excuse, so to speak, of hopelessness and helplessness in the face of an overwhelming failure in life. That is symbolized by the expansion of the nega, as if the person says, "I sinned and I'll do it again." You know, there's a famous medrash when Hashem confronted Adam HaRishon. You know, "Who told you you were naked?" Etc. So Adam HaRishon said, first he blames the woman, that's the defense thing, but there are two things. He says, "Oh, that woman you gave me," he's actually blaming Hashem, "the woman you gave me that fruit." So there's a double evasion of responsibility. He's blaming Chava, and he's blaming Hashem for giving him Chava. But in the second half of the verse he says, "The woman that you gave me the fruit, and I ate it." So the Medrash comments, "V'ochal," can be translated both as a past and as a future. And the Medrash says, "Ochalti," I ate it, and I'll do it again. Now most people interpret this Medrash as really gross defiance. He's telling God, "You're going to stop me? I'll do it again." Now that's not a wise remark to make at that particular juncture. Even though it's true, Hashem gives us Bechira, and in fact He did it again, or at least we do it again, that's for sure. But you know, you don't say that to Hashem at that point. But I would suggest that there's something deeper in the Medrash. This is not a statement of defiance. It is a cry of despair. Adam Arishon said, I sinned and I know I'm going to do it again. I can't pull myself out of it. Begging Hashem for rachamim, because I've become connected to this and I don't know how to get out of it. I did it and I'll do it again. It is the weak, weak little Adam that is saying this to Hashem, not the arrogant Baal Gaiva. Peace. Yeah, yeah. Please.
I just wanted to ask about Miriam when she got Sarah.
Yes.
Why didn't Aharon get it also? They were both talking about Moshe and Israel.
Yeah, you know, it is a good question. Why Aharon wasn't Nanash if they were both speaking Lashon Hara? It could, number one, be that possibly Miriam was a greater tzaddikus, and as a result, she was held more accountable for her sin than was Aaron. In fact, Hashem is stricter with the great tzaddikim than he is. It could also be that because Aaron was needed as a Kohen, he couldn't be taken out of commission. So that might be another possibility as well. Hashem needed him in his job at that particular juncture. But it's a good question. Yeah.
You said when this man has Sarat, that it doesn't hurt him. But the thing is, his reputation will be destroyed. So therefore, automatically, you go into denial and say, "But is it so bad?" Or I.
Yeah.
I mean, the threat of your reputation being put into quarantine.
No, I understand that. I understand that.
So
but
hurt him.
No, I'm not sure. I don't think I said it didn't hurt him.
I don't know if he meant physically, or you said something about it doesn't hurt him.
I'm not sure what you're referring to actually, but I admit, of course, it will hurt him psychologically, but we like to give defenses, right? We don't want to acknowledge
that's
that
our
you know
knee-jerk reaction.
Every person, I mean, again, all of us go through the idea of giving ourselves defenses, you know. When other people give excuses for bad things that they do, we see through them. We tend to be fairly perceptive in seeing through the excuses of others. We have a little more difficulty seeing through the excuses we give ourselves, but you know, that's true. That's true as well. So the first siman tuma of the white hair is the one who denies and evades and does not accept responsibility. Go back into quarantine and think about that. The second siman tuma is the person that is so overwhelmed with failure that they feel there is no chance, and that is the thing grows bigger. Message: go back and think about it. Life is not hopeless. Hashem has given you powers. You can do tshuva. Tshuva is a gift, and it's also a responsibility. Because if we have that power to change and to grow and to improve, then we have a responsibility to exercise it. Now, there's a third response a person has that's a bit more subtle, and that third response is not a intellectual denial of guilt, but it is simply a person might know they did something wrong, but they simply don't want to let it affect them right now. There may be what you might call emotional inertia. Maybe because if they think about it, they'll turn into category two, hopelessness. Right? So their response might be, I'm sure maybe you've even said these words about all sorts of things. I'm just not gonna think about it right now. It makes me upset. That is what we might call not denial, because you know you did something wrong and you know there's no excuse, but I'm not gonna let it affect my equilibrium. That is symbolized by the healthy flesh in the middle. Because you're surrounded by rot, surrounded by that illness, but you don't let yourself think about it. You don't let it penetrate. You know, there was, I think I mentioned it last week, forgive me for repeating, a famous professor, American academician, who was once asked, why doesn't he exercise? Why doesn't he take care of himself? So he says, well, I do get the urge to run every once in a while, but I know if I lie down for a few minutes, it'll just go away. So I don't let it bother me. And in Ruchnius, it's certainly that way. I don't let it bother me. So the three simanim of tuma represent the three responses we have to not doing tshuva. One is denial and evasion. The other is hopelessness, and the third is emotional inertia, by not letting it penetrate our heart. In all three of these cases, if any one of them exists, the Mitzvah has to go back and reflect. If they don't exist after 2 weeks, he goes home. Now you might say, why does he go home? He still has the nega. The answer is this. He doesn't have to complete the tshuva in isolation. The quarantine was a spur to begin the tshuva process. As long as he doesn't have the wrong mindsets, he can go home and be mashlim the idea of tshuva. Right? He doesn't need the whole ceremony. But if he has those mindsets, he has to remain till the whole sin is eradicated. The tzaras goes away, he counts 7 days of purity, a whole week of purity, and then he brings korbanos. Now, how is all of this relevant to Pesach? All of us know, of course, that the central message of Pesach, on the most superficial level, is chametz bad, matzah good. Okay? Chametz is bad. Okay. What's so bad about chametz? So there are many, many explanations. The most famous explanation, of course, is chametz represents arrogance, it's puffed up, it represents being filled with oneself, it is ego, it is gaiva, and matzah is flat, it represents humility, submission. Therefore, it is only by humility and modesty and tznius that we come into the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? That is the most famous. Which is why I think there is at least a hashgafa question about the various Pesach products that simulate chametz. I just saw something in the Jerusalem Post that some chef here invented a kosher Pesach bagel, and he claims it's identical to a bagel. Now, if it's not chametz, I can't tell you halachically you're not allowed to eat it. I mean, l'chari you're allowed to eat it. But it would seem that if there is something significant in the visualization aspect of chametz and matzah, then one could say it's not really so proper to, I don't want to be sued by anybody, but it's not really so proper to eat things that have the same puffed up nature as chametz and the like. So that's one aspect of chametz. But the Maharal of Prague, the Maharal says, there are two other ideas of chametz. One is, chametz represents spoilage, because chametz spoils. Chametz, because of fermentation, eventually turns rotten and moldy. It gets worse with the passage of time. So chametz represents the progressive deterioration of something. Matzah really does not spoil. In fact, I don't know if it's true, but I read somewhere once that they actually found some matzah in Masada. I don't know if that's true, but apparently it would still be edible and the like. Maybe that was last year's shmur matzah, some people feel. That shmur matzah must come from Masada. But be it as it may, the Maharal says, therefore, matzah represents goodness and kedusha because it doesn't deteriorate or spoil. Chametz represents evil because it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. See, the Vilna Gaon says in Mishlei that there's no such thing as being on a plateau. If you're not consciously going up, it's like an escalator. If you stand still on a downward escalator, even though you're not going up, you're automatically going down. Okay, you have to specifically try to go up. I don't know if you ever did this as a kid, or your children do it, trying to go up on a down escalator. It takes a lot of work, but you know, you can do it. Even if you're going against the movement of the escalator. Okay. The third explanation of chametz, the Maharal says, is chametz represents inertia and matzah represents action. Because when water falls on flour, you don't need to do anything to make it chametz. If you just leave it alone, it will become chametz. In order to make it matzah, you gotta do something. You gotta bake it to arrest the fermentation. So the Maharal says, the evil of chametz is chametz represents the lack of movement, the lack of initiative. It represents inertia, dead weight, not doing things. Kedusha requires action, investment. So we have these three ideas of matzah. One is matzah and chametz. One is chametz is arrogance. Two is chametz is spoilage. 3, chametz is inertia. Think about this. This corresponds very neatly to the 3 simanei tuma of the mitzvah. The sar lavan, the whitewashing, comes from a sense of gaiva. Because of my gaiva, because of my arrogance, I refuse to acknowledge even to myself that I did anything wrong. That's the chametz. So the sar lavan corresponds to chametz as gaiva. Pisayam, the expansion of the nega as a result of hopelessness and helplessness, corresponds to the chametz as that which rots and spoils and gets worse with time. And finally, the emotional inertia of not letting it bother me is the chametz of inertia. So in many, many ways, the 3 simanim of tuma track precisely 3 aspects of the chametz that make chametz a sign of evil. And I'll just end with this idea. A very important part of the Seder, perhaps this could have been chosen as the most important part of the Haggadah, is the statement of Rabban Gamliel that anyone who does not explain 3 commandments of Pesach has not fulfilled their obligation, and that is Pesach, the Korban Pesach, the eating of the matzah, and the Morar. And this is very important, because even if you said no other part of the Haggadah but this, you must say this part of the Haggadah. There's a little bit of an anomaly here, because this part of the Haggadah is towards the end of Maggid, and people are already getting ready to eat, so sometimes whoever is serving in the kitchen might be getting up to get food and other things. The Chayei Adam warns us that it's extremely important that that part of the Haggadah be read. Again, Hebrew, English, that makes no difference. Your Yotze Haggadah in any language. But women, or whoever's doing the serving, usually it's women, but whoever is doing it is obligated to be sure to recite that part of the Haggadah. But what are the symbols? So let me go in reverse order, and then I'll go back why the Haggadah doesn't go in reverse order. Maror, matzah, Pesach. We eat maror to remind ourselves of slavery. Central message: the first step to being free is that you honestly acknowledge to yourself what your Mitzrayim is. If one denies being a slave, like the whitewash, one denies that there's anything wrong in their midos, you cannot be free. So Moror is the courage to cognitively admit that I am in a state of slavery to a bad midah. Matzah represents the imperative of action, right? Overcoming inertia. You can go to psychoanalysis. Okay, you could go to psychoanalysis, and you could go for 50 years to understand all of your dysfunctions, and you can have a lot of insight. You could trace everything from birth trauma to pre-birth trauma to preconception traumas that psychically impacted on you, and you could spend many, many years. But the question is, what do you do with that information? Do you use it as a vehicle of transformation, or do you just keep on going into therapy forever and ever and ever? Matzah says, take your insight and do something with it. The imperative of action. What does Pesach represent? So the Rambam says the Korban Pesach is an unusual Korban because the Torah requires that it be brought with other people. Even if I have a big appetite and I have a small lamb, because remember, the Korban Pesach only has to be 30 days old. So you can have a tiny lamb, and theoretically, a guy with a big appetite could finish the whole thing himself. Although I'm thinking, it would still be a pretty big meal. But he could. And yet the halacha is absolutely clear. You must bring the Korban Pesach with other people, either your family, or if you don't have a family, you have to join with the family. What is the lesson? Community. Togetherness. You want to eradicate your Mitzrayim, you have to do so with other people, because the meaning of friendship in Ruchnius is each person gives chizuk to the other person. When I'm weak, my friend picks me up. What does Shlomo HaMelech say? Tovim hashnayim min o'echa, two are better than one, Because when you have two people and one falls, the other picks him up when you're by yourself. Now, hopefully, we zocha to marriages, reyim ahuvim, where one has that in a marriage. But even if one unfortunately does not have that particular bracha, we have to find in our world friends that pick us up, that give us chizuk, that give us strength. That is why a program like Li'ela is specifically so wonderful, besides the actual Torah learning, but the notion of people coming together to give each other chizuk. Yeah.
What happens to the person, I'm not sure I got this, that doesn't have the simanim,
yeah,
but the nega doesn't go away?
The meaning is, he still has work to do, but he's ready to go home. He can do his rehabilitation at home. That's what it means. In other words, he still has it, but he's learning his lessons. He's progressing. We can release him from the hospital. That's exactly what it would mean. So, what are the three lessons of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror? Going in reverse order, but then I'll explain why Rabbi Gamliel has it in a different order. Maror is the honesty of recognizing our Mitzrayim. Matzah, the empowerment that we can do something about it. And Pesach, the need for a community to give us that framework. Good. Now you might say, one final question. Okay, so why does Rabban Gamliel give the order Pesach, Matzah, Moror? It should be Moror, Matzah, Pesach. And even in the Seder it's difficult. Why do we eat Matzah before Moror? If Moror is, I have this slavery within me, and Matzah is, I can do something about it, we ought to eat Moror before Matzah, instead of Matzah before Moror. Right? So it's not only Akasha and Rabban Gamliel, it's Akasha in the order of the Seder itself. And the answer is the following. If you were to start off with Moror, you might become overwhelmed, depressed, and hopeless. I can't start off with all of the things I need to correct. That is overwhelming. I first need to be part of a community that gives me strength. Pesach. I then need to be convinced about my ability to take action in life, which is matzah. And only when I have those inner resources within me and the community that gives me the chizuk can I then get into the difficult work of knowing my slavery, identifying my slavery, and then being able to go beyond it. So indeed, you need the Pesach and the matzah in place before you're ready to confront the Moror. So this is kind of a connection between Saras. Again, most years we don't have this because we read about Saras after Pesach. But on the Nibriyor we have the extra ability to bring this idea, or these ideas, into our discussion. And again, I know that this is a extremely, extremely busy time. But as we get rid of our bread and as we clean our houses, although as Rav Scheinberg never fail to remark, Pesach cleaning is not spring cleaning. One needs to remember all of that. But as we're so busy, and particularly the women are so conscientious, the Nashim Tzidkaniyos are so conscientious on Hamashu of Chametz, let us at least devote a little bit of time to the Chametz of our hearts as well, and try to eradicate that. And then we become people that are worthy of Geula, and may the month of Nisan be the Zman of Geula Shleima.